Do you, Baron Frankenstein, take this woman to be your bride? Do you promise to haunt her with old horror movies, toys, and comics?
Yes, I want Fran. Woman. Fran.
And you, Baroness, do you take this man beast to be your lawfully bound husband? Do you promise to endure hours of unimaginable torture as he rambles about monster movies and long-dead actors? Close enough. Then by the power invested in me by Count Alucard, I now pronounce you supermates. You may bite or kiss the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 61 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And we are on part two of The House of Frankenstein for 2016. In case you missed last episode, that is where we talk about a classic monster movie and a superhero comic that features a similar monster battling a superhero, which would make sense in a superhero comic. Last time we did a Universal monster movie, and this time we kind of are too, because this was a Universal release. But more importantly, it's a Hammer film. So we're crossing the pond, venturing back into Hammerland for their only foray into lycanthropy, The Curse of the Werewolf.
You want a treat?
You roll up, roll over and let Uncle Clark scratch your belly. Let's see.
It's best to just let him finish.
Nice. It's our pride and joy snots. We got off track really quick. And even like a minute in, and here we go. Before we get started, I would like to thank a friend of ours for recommending a book. Our friend and fellow podcaster, Derek M. Cook of Monster Kid Radio, where I recently guested, talking about Star Trek Monsters, and 1951 Down Place, which is a Hammer movies podcast, recently recommended to me The Hammer Story by Marcus Ahern and Alan Barnes. Now, I had contacted Derek, and I said, you know, Derek, what Hammer book should I get? I don't have a Hammer book. You know, everything else I've read, I've watched documentaries, I've looked on IMDb and different websites, but I didn't have a book. And I like to have a book with pictures. I've got a Universal book that we talk about. And he said, he recommended one that's unfortunately out of print and very expensive. But his second choice was The Hammer Story, The Authorized History of Hammer Films by Marcus Hearn and Alan Barnes. And I have been just going through this thing ever since I got it. I mean, it's exhaustive. I mean, it's pretty much... I mean,
in the best possible way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... segment on there's a at least one whole page, usually two pages, devoted to every major picture they did, mostly the horror films,
right?
Because that's what they're known for. They did other films, but they're mostly known for horror films. I have been just, you know, plowing through this, and I knew we were going to do a couple Hammer movies anyway,
right?
We always do, but I just wanted to have a kind of a more authoritative backup this time. So I appreciate it, Derek. And of course, we'll be running the 1951 Down Place trailer in this episode. This movie, The Curse of the Werewolf, as I said, was actually released through Universal, who of course created the modern werewolf myth with the Wolfman. And we discussed that last time, that just about every trope of lycanthropy that appears in every book and every movie since then actually came from the Wolfman. And it was a slow process because, you know, you got the full moon in the first movie and you got Silver. But it wasn't until the last movie that we just talked about last time, The House of Frankenstein, that you got the Silver Bullet. And the Silver Bullet will come into play in this movie. So that just shows you how influential the Larry Talbot cycle, the Lon Chaney Jr. Cycle of Wolfman movies, was on that particular monster. Strangely enough, this was based on the same source material as Universal's first lycanthrope film, Werewolf of London. Both films were very loosely based on Guy Endor's novel, The Werewolf of Paris, which I've never read. I haven't read it. So apparently it didn't become Frankenstein or Dracula, you know.
Gotcha.
It didn't. I mean, they maybe partially because it's never been faithfully adapted, you know, if somebody had. Maybe it has and I just don't know about it, but... there's very little in common with this movie and Werewolf of London.
Right.
So it just shows you how, you know, they basically took off in totally different directions. I believe this movie is closer to the book, although they changed the setting, obviously. And we'll get into that, because they originally were going to film it as The Werewolf of Paris. So, Curse of the Werewolf was released June 7th, 1961 in the USA. Again, nice Halloween date there. Mm-hmm. Directed by Terrence Fisher, who had started the horror cycle. Ed Hammer had directed, by this point, had directed The Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula, or The Horror of Dracula, as we know it. And I think Brides of Dracula, I know he did The Mummy. We talked about The Mummy last year. And I think Brides of Dracula came before this one. The screenplay was by Anthony Hines, who was one of the head honchos of Hammer, but he used the pseudonym of John Elder so he wouldn't get in trouble, basically, with the unions, because he was producer and writer. And, of course, like we said, it's based on the book by Guy Endor. Top billed is Clifford Evans, who plays Alfredo. Oliver Reed plays Leon, who is our werewolf. Yvonne Romaine plays the servant girl. They don't give her a name. Catherine Feller is Christina. Anthony Dawson is the Marquis Sinestro. Yes, Sinestro, folks. We'll get into that later. Joseph Llewellyn is the Marquesa. Richard Wordsworth is the beggar. Hira Talfrey is Teresa. Justin Walters is young Leon. John Gabriel is the priest. Warren Mitchell is Pepe Valente. Anne Blake is Rosa Valente. George Woodbridge is Dominique. Michael Ripper is the old soak. And Ewan Solan is Don Fernando.
After an opening credit sequence where we stare deep into the red, bloodshot eyes of a werewolf, our story begins in Spain. And according to our narrator, it's some 200 years ago.
Some 200 years ago, a beggar came to the little town of Santa Vera in search of charity. Although a simple man, he was not so simple that he did not know when it was a weekday and when it was Sunday. And although the church bell was sounding and all the little shops were closed and there was no one in the square, he knew this was not a Sunday.
Curious about the bells on Sunday and the lack of people in the street, the beggar enters a local pub where he learns the townspeople have been forced to take a holiday in honor of the wedding of the Marquise. One of the men jokingly suggests that the beggar seek food at the lavish reception dinner the Marquise is throwing, and the beggar does so. He arrives at the door, not knowing the cruel Marquise has already humiliated and assaulted his chef in front of his bride and guest. The sneering lord buys the beggar for a purse full of coins as a gift to his new wife. He orders him to drink and then dance for their amusement. He finally tosses the starving man a half-eaten chicken leg as he and the Marquesa retire for the evening. As they walk out, the now drunken beggar wishes them a good night with a wink in his eye.
Good night. Thank you, senor. Have a good night.
You insolent.
Don't forget he's mine. A wedding gift for my husband. I don't want my gift to be damaged.
You're quite right, my dear. He must be looked after. You'll see he's looked after.
For his insolence, the beggar is thrown in the castle dungeon, where he is forgotten. Only the jailer and his mute daughter seem to recall his presence there and feed him. As the years passed, the beggar was completely forgotten by the Marquis, and the jailer died, leaving his now grown and beautiful daughter as the strangely hairy beggar's only contact with human life.
The Marquesa had died from years of living with such an evil man. The Marquess himself had become as ugly on the outside as he was on the inside, and one night he approached the servant girl when she was cleaning his quarters. When he made advances on her, she bit him and ran off. The Marquess ordered her thrown into the dungeon. She soon came to realize the danger she was in. Her old friend, the prisoner, was now nothing more than a savage animal, and he acted upon his animalistic desires by raping her.
The next morning, the girl awoke to find her assailant dead. The guards released her and sent her to the Marquis. Instead of the pleasure he expected, she brought pain and then death by stabbing him repeatedly with a sharpened torch holder.
Good for her.
The girl ran off into the forest, where she lived for several months before being discovered, face down in the river, by Don Alfredo Carrito, who is also our narrator. Alfredo takes her back to his home, where his housemaid Teresa brings her back to health and discovers she is pregnant. Teresa grows concerned that the unwanted baby will be born on Christmas Day and what her old superstitions say about such things.
Senor, I'm beginning to be a bit worried.
What about?
Of course you may think me superstitious.
You
may think me superstitious, but I've seen a good deal more of the world than you have. The real world, not what you read about in your old books. You know, it will soon be the 25th.
25th?
Of December. You know what that means.
Well, the 25th is always on Christmas Day.
Well, then.
Christmas Day is always on the 25th.
Of course, if you're going to make fun of me.
No, I'm not making fun of you. I don't understand. What's the matter? What's worrying you?
What worries me is that the girl upstairs is about to have her baby. And as like as not, it'll be born on the very hour of our Lord's birth.
Surely that should be a reason to rejoice.
For an unwanted child to be born then is an insult to heaven, Senor. That's what I was taught. In the village where I come from, the girls stay away from the men in March and April. Just in case. Let's pray the little child is born too soon. Or too late. Otherwise...
Don't worry. We'll have it born exactly to suit you.
Oh.
Of course, the baby is born on Christmas Day, and as he enters this world, Don Alfredo hears the first howl of a wolf, and then a baby's cry. The mother passes away moments after her delivery, leaving Alfredo and Teresa to care for him. When they take the infant, now named Leon, to the priest for his baptism, the sunny skies become stormy, and the baptismal waters begin to quake. A demonic face appears in the water, but Don Alfredo shrugs it off as the reflection from the cathedral gargoyle above.
Several years pass again, and the local watchman and tavern owner, Pepe, finds the body of a farmer's goat with its throat ripped out. He first blames it on a shepherd dog belonging to another farmer named Dominique, but soon begins to believe that a wolf is on the prowl nearby. Talking to Teresa, he learns Leon's cat died from a similar attack. Teresa is concerned that little Leon seems to have lost his appetite of late.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Given an ultimatum by the mayor, Pepe sets out to kill the wolf, and that night shoots what he believes is the beast in question. He finds a trail of blood, but no body.
In his room, Don Alfredo and Teresa work to remove a bullet from a feverish Leon's leg. Later, they puzzle how Leon could have been shot. Seeking answers, Don Alfredo questions Leon and is startled by what he hears.
Now, I want you to tell me everything, Leon. Promise?
I promise.
And truthfully?
Yes.
Where did you go last night?
Go, Uncle?
Yes. I know you went out. Where did you go?
I was in bed all night, Uncle.
Oh, Leon, you promised to tell me the truth.
I am telling the truth.
Then how did you get hurt?
I don't know, Uncle.
Well, you couldn't have been hurt like that in bed.
I know I was in bed, Uncle. I woke up in the night. I had a bad dream, woke up. But then I went to sleep again.
And what did you dream?
I don't really remember, Uncle. Not very clearly. But it was like other nights.
Other nights?
I have bad dreams every night now, Uncle.
I see. Tell me, Leon, when did these dreams start?
I think it was after I went out hunting with little Peppy. He wanted to show me how to shoot. He wanted me to shoot a squirrel, but I wouldn't, so he shot it for me. He pulled the trigger, and the little squirrel squeaked and dropped. It was horrible. I picked it up and tried to kiss it better. I kissed it, and I tasted something warm. Must have been the blood, but it tasted sweet. I wanted to keep on tasting it, but Pepe took it away. I did wrong. Did I, Uncle?
No, no, I don't think so, Leon.
Ever since then, I've had bad dreams, Uncle.
What do you dream?
I dream I'm wolf, like in a picture book. I dream I'm wolf, drinking blood. Help me, Uncle, please help me.
Yes, I'll help you.
He looks at Leon's hands and palms and finds them covered in coarse fur. Teresa takes the bullet removed from Leon to Pepe's wife, Rosa, who confirms it's one of her husband's bullets. Teresa says she found it embedded in a tree trunk, adding to the notion that Pepe had failed in his job once more.
Don Alfredo visits the priest, who tells him that wandering bestial spirits can sometimes possess living beings at birth, especially those who were born under less than optimum circumstances. He does offer some amount of hope. Love can help the spirit of man conquer the warring beast within him.
A werewolf. That is what he is, my son. A werewolf is a body with a soul and a spirit that are constantly at war. The spirit is that of a wolf. And whatever weakens the human soul, vice, greed, hatred, solitude, especially during the cycle of the full moon when the forces of evil are at their strongest, these bring the spirit of the wolf to the fore. And in turn, whatever weakens the spirit of the beast, warmth, fellowship, love, raise the human soul. Now, little Leon has no real father or mother, and yet he needs their love and care far more than any normal child.
I understand, Father, and I shall do my best to replace that love.
I know you will, my son.
But is there no cure?
Only love. When he's older, he may meet a young girl whom he will love very deeply. But what is more important, she should love him very deeply. Then he may be saved.
An old soak holds court at the tavern, testifying that the beast attacking the local animals was more than just a wolf. Pepe takes this to heart and melts his wife's silver crucifix, fashioning a bullet. Meanwhile, Alfredo bars up the windows to Leon's room.
That night on watch, Pepe hears the wolf's cry and fires. Alfredo and Teresa find Leon in his room pulling at the bars, desperately trying to escape, his arms covered in fur and his teeth like fangs. They put him back to bed while Pepe discovers he has shot Dominique's old dog. Believing the local beast is dead, he considers his work done.
We leap forward 10 years or so, and our narrator, Don Alfredo, tells us that the love he and Teresa gave Leon as he grew kept his nightmarish existence completely at bay from then on. Leon is off to a nearby village to find work on his own at a vineyard. Arriving there, Leon is splashed by the passing coach of the landowner's pompous son, Rico Gomez, out for a date with his fiancée, Christina, daughter of the vineyard manager, Don Fernando. Leon is introduced to his co-worker, Jose, who shows Leon the ropes and warns him against trying for Christina. Leon is instantly smitten when Christina apologizes for Rico's rude behavior earlier. Several days later, Christina cuts short a date with the vapid Rico once more, and we learn that she and Leon have begun a passionate secret affair. Leon tries to convince her to run away with him so that they can be married.
Oh, I thought you were never coming.
I thought I'd never get here. This is just a dream.
Oh, no, this is real, Christina.
What if my father finds out?
Come away with me, Christina.
Oh, if it was only as simple as that.
I love you.
Oh, Leon.
I want you to marry me.
I can't. You know that. It has all been arranged for me. I'm to marry Rico Gomez.
Marry me, Christina.
Oh, my father would never let me.
Let me speak to your father.
No, you mustn't. Promise me you won't. He'd send you away. We'd never see each other again. He'd see to that.
Anybody there?
You. Tomorrow.
Sunday then.
Sunday.
Jose convinces Leon to go out dancing with him Saturday night. The two head to a den of ill repute where Jose, for his week's pay, proves popular with the ladies. Leon ignores several ladies interested in him as he suddenly takes ill. He goes outside for air and notices the full moon. Then a rather headstrong lady with ideas of her own offers up her room for him to rest in. Wonder what her occupation is. Up in her room, Leon goes from uninterested to savage as he stares at the moon. It gets a bit too rough even for this floozy when he draws blood on her neck. When she turns back to look at him again, what she sees leaves her dumbstruck and soon dead.
Jose goes looking for his missing friend and finds him, or what he's become. Despite their friendship, the beast that controls Leon murders him. Back at the town tavern, a drunken Dominique is still going on about Pepe murdering his dog years ago, admonishing him for wearing the bullet he used to murder him. Walking home from the tavern, he's attacked by the real culprit of those animal killings and joins his victims.
The next morning, Don Alfredo was shocked to find a feverish and naked Leon in his room, the bars mangled from the outside. Leon looks at his hands and they are covered in blood. Later, Alfredo, Teresa, and the priest finally tell Leon the truth.
No, no, no!
It's the truth, my son.
I won't believe it. I can't.
Leon, I must ask you once again, can you remember anything you did? No. Or where you went to last night?
No.
But try, please, try.
I can't, I tell you. I can't remember anything. The blood. There's blood on my hands. Where did I get blood on my hand?
That's what I'm trying to find out. Perhaps it's the blood of some animal. A sheep, maybe.
You mean I killed it with... There, there.
You knew about this all the time, Father. But you didn't tell anyone. Thank you. What am I going to do? Tell me what am I going to do, Father? I think I can obtain permission for you to enter a monastery under special supervision, but... until then, you must be chained and watched night and day.
Oh, yes, that's right, isn't it? They chain up wild animals. That's all I am, an animal!
A despondent Leon runs away, back to the vineyard, where he finds the local police waiting to question him about the events of last night. They leave without telling Leon what became of Jose. That night, as he waits for the full moon, Christina arrives. Leon urgently begs her to get away from him, but he falls and passes out as he tries to escape from her. The next morning, he awakens in Christina's arms, astonished to find he did not change.
Leon? Huh? Leon, I must go before Father finds out I've been with you all night.
All night? All night. Been here with me all night?
Yes.
Tell me, I must know. Did anything happen to me?
You hurt your leg. You were frightened and screaming.
No, let me... no! Did I change? My face changed. My hands. Did anything happen?
No, Leo.
You saved me. Oh, God, thank you for sending her to me. We must go away now, today. You must marry me and we must go away.
Leo.
We'll start a new life. A wonderful life, Christina. We'll be together every minute of the day and night.
Tell me, what's wrong?
Christina... do you love me? Will you marry me, Christina? You say you love me, will you marry me?
Yes. Yes, I will.
My darling, this is terribly important. But you must trust me till I have time to explain better. We must go away, now, today. Please don't ask me any more questions. Will you come?
Yes. Yes, I'll come with you.
Leon's and Christina's happy plans are short-lived as the police return to arrest him for the murders. He is thrown in the town jail, sharing a cell with the old soap from the tavern. Leon bribes a guard to fetch Don Alfredo for him. Meanwhile, Christina is found looking for Leon by her father and Rico, who know of her plans to run off. When her father tells her Leon has been arrested, she takes Rico's carriage to town. Don Alfredo and the priest arrive at the jail, and Leon's guilt leads him to a shocking decision. He feels he must be executed immediately.
I've already killed 3 people, Father. Can't you understand this? Strangled them with my hands. Savaged them with my teeth. That has yet to be proved.
proof. They'll prove it all right because it's true. And if they make me stay here tonight, it's going to happen all over again. No. Don't think these are going to stop me.
What can we do? We must go to the mayor.
Appeal to him. No, not appeal. Tell him. Tell him what I am. Tell him I've confessed to everything.
What?
Tell him I've confessed. That he must have me executed. Now.
My son.
Yes, now. Before sunset. And father, you must tell him how it must be done.
Burned
alive.
The mayor refuses to believe it and insists he stand trial. He visits Leon in his cell, where he is convinced the prisoner is no monster. When Christina arrives and declares she is Leon's fiancée, the mayor takes her lack of knowledge concerning Leon's affliction as confirmation it's all bunk. Leon desperately wants Christina to stay with him, but his pleas fall on deaf ears. As Don Alfredo leaves, Leon begs his adoptive father to do what must be done.
Father, the bullet.
Pepe the Watchman has a silver bullet. Get it and use it. Use it on me, father. You must use it, do you hear? You must use it, you must.
The priest tries to convince Christina of Leon's curse, but she won't believe it. Meanwhile, Don Alfredo tracks down Pepe as the sun begins to set. His cell, Leon succumbs to the rising moon's influence and transforms before the astonished eyes of the old soak. He murders him and the prison guard and escapes. The priest drops Christina off to Teresa, who wonders where Don Alfredo has gone. When Christina mentions a silver bullet, Teresa knows what is to happen next.
I can't think where Don Alfredo has got to. There was something about a silver bullet. Pepe's silver bullet. So it's come to that at last.
Come to what?
What is this bullet? A silver bullet. Made from a crucifix. The only bullet that will kill a werewolf.
Don Alfredo arrives in town, rifle in hand, to find the people up in arms and torches out, ready to hunt Leon down. The gobsmacked mayor confirms Alfredo was right all along. Leon prowls the rooftops, evading the advancing mob. Christina arrives in the town square and catches a glimpse of the man she loved, now a savage monster. After hurling a flaming hay bale at the angry mob below, Leon climbs to the cathedral's bell tower. As Don Alfredo makes his way up to the tower stairs, a villager rings the bell, the sound assaulting the werewolf's sensitive ears. Leon grabs the bell in an effort to stop it, then notices Don Alfredo taking aim in the stairwell. He fires and Leon writhes and drops almost instantly. As the angry mob makes its way inside, Alfredo places his cape over the monstrous visage of the boy he loved as a son, while Teresa and Christina comfort each other below.
Good ending of the year.
Yeah.
You know, this film begins with church bells and it ends with church bells. Mm-hmm. That's very poetic. I think that's a nice touch. And that just ties into director Terrence Fisher was often quoted as saying he thought his gothic horror films for Hammer more as adult fairy tales rather than true horror stories. I don't think there is any Hammer film that feels more fairy tale like than this one. Maybe it's the different setting or the doomed romance. I think it's many elements overall, and we'll get to them as we talk about it.
Okay.
The opening credits scenes are different, and they work well since it's going to be a long time before we see Oliver Reed or the werewolf.
Right, right.
You can see the outer rim of his red bloodshot contact lenses, you know, because it's so close up. But and Andrew actually watched this with us, and he asked, he's watched it many times before, but he asked, was he supposed to be crying? Because there's tears, like his eyes are watering up.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe he wasn't, and maybe it's just irritation coming from the contacts, but it worked.
It definitely works. Yeah. He's a tortured soul.
Right. Oh, definitely, yeah. Okay, we later learn that Don Alfredo narrates this whole film. At the beginning, he says it's Spain some 200 years ago.
Uh-huh.
He must be talking about 200 years before 1962, because we meet Leon's biological parents, so it can't be 200 years between the time of the beggar and the time of the rest of the film. So one, how is Don Alfredo telling us this? He's not an omniscient narrator. He's a character in the movie.
Right.
He's a mortal character who must have died at least 150 years ago.
What they should have done is framed it as a journal.
From the journal of Don Alfredo Carrido. Yes. Yeah.
That's how they should have framed this.
Yeah.
And that would have set this up, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess you can kind of assume that.
Right, but...
But also, how did he know about Leon's origins? Leon's mother was mute.
Right.
And there was no indication she ever wrote her history down. Did he consult with someone after the fact who filled him in on the deal with the beggar, the Marquis, and the servant girl? If so, who would know all those details?
Right.
Because the beggar was forgotten.
Right.
So, it kind of... we don't have a very reliable narrator, you know, that... I mean, I love this movie, but, you know, I hadn't even ever really thought about any of this stuff before. That's one thing I hate about doing podcasts.
I know, it makes you analyze something that you accepted at face value before.
Right, right. So, how did the Werewolf of Paris become the Werewolf of Santa Vera, Spain, according to the script? Hammer had planned a historical horror adventure movie called The Inquisitor, where the Spanish Inquisition comes to a small town in the late 1500s, set to film immediately before Curse of the Werewolf at their home, Bray Studios. The Catholic Legion of Decency got wind of the production and apparently told Hammer they would not allow the film to be released.
Huh.
This was after many of the sets had already been designed by Hammer mainstay Bernard Robinson and built. Already embroiled in constant battles with British and American censors, which was really, apparently really bad, at one of the worst times they ever had with them at this time, Hammer had no desire to take on the church, so they scrapped the entire project and changed werewolf setting to Spain instead of France. So there you go.
They probably just saved the sets and, you know, don't you think, reused?
Well, I mean, they were getting ready to film this right beforehand. So, I mean, it's like they just bumped this one up, I guess, in production a little bit.
Yeah.
Because they basically... Where Hammer at one point, they eventually branched out and started using other studios, but they had a home studio at Bray Studios, which is, the address of the main house was 1951 Down Place, which is where the guys get their show name from.
Right.
They usually just shot one movie at a time, so that's one reason why you had basically a repertory company. You know, you had the same actors, or at least some of them, and the same director, and the same writer, and the same cinematographer, and... set designer and music, usually there's a whole lot of, you know, sameness in the Hammer movies, which gives it that consistent feel.
Right.
But later on, they started branching out more, and a lot of people think that kind of Hammer lost its feel when they quit using Bray. You know, that the post Bray ones are a little
uniqueness.
Yeah, its uniqueness was kind of gone. Like we said, the Marquis name isn't given in the movie, but the credits. His name tells any comic fan why he's such an arrogant, evil SOB. His name is Marquis Sinestro.
You know? Why do you telegraph?
Which not only, yeah, telegraphs that he's evil, but to us also says he's an arrogant, you know, power-hungry SOB. The scenes with the Marquis are pretty hard to watch because he's such an awful prick.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just, it's much like the three cads in Hammer's Frankenstein-created woman. I remember that?
Yeah.
Oh, God, those guys. I mean, just... And so I've heard some people on Down Place that wrote in about that show. They said, it's, you know, it's kind of uncomfortable, that movie, because of them. They're so deplorable that you just... I mean, you want to reach through... You want to punch your television screen and choke them.
Yeah.
And this guy's right behind them. You know, I mean, he's awful. Now, blink and you'll miss James Bond's Q himself, Desmond Llewellyn. He plays the doorman who tries to shoo the beggar off. Mm-hmm. And the beggar, Richard Wordsworth, was actually, I haven't seen this movie yet, but I need to, Hammer's first true hit that kind of pointed the way toward their horror films was an adaptation of a BBC TV drama called The Quatermass Experiment. And BBC had, Hammer had been adapting BBC radio shows and TV shows, but The Quatermass Experiment was a TV miniseries in the mid-50s that really took off. Hammer got the rights to do it, and Richard Wordsworth played the astronaut who is changed by something from outer space and starts to turn into a monster. So he's good at playing guys that turn into monsters. You know, as much as I love this movie, do you think the scenes with the beggar take too much time?
When you're considering how long before you see the main character, yes.
Right.
But if there had been something, I do.
I appreciate them setting the mood and everything, but it just, I think they could have, you know, one thing Hammer gets criticized for sometimes is the pacing. And I do kind of feel like the pacing is, we get pretty quick that the Marquis is an ass, and he's going to humiliate the beggar in front of everybody. And he even humiliates the chef, that's a good setup, you know, that so we know that, oh God, this beggar's in for it. But, you know, later, even when the girl, jumping ahead, the servant girl attacks the Marquis, we get the scene of him, like, reaching in his drawer and wrapping his hand up, and we really didn't need all that.
And
you know?
Picking the skin off of his nasty old face. Yeah. Wow.
Which, that's another thing. I mean, we'll get to that in a minute. We might as well talk about it. That's another thing that makes this movie feel more fairy tale like. I mean, why is he that hideous looking? Right. I mean, he looks like a zombie.
Oh, yeah.
He's got gray, pallid skin, and he's got all these growths on his face. I mean, he almost looks like something out of Plague of the Zombies from a few years later.
He is nasty.
He is very nasty, yeah. So,
makes you think about Dorian Gray. His outside family matches his inside.
Yeah, true. So, the eternal question is always, and Andrew brought this up again when we watched it, why is the beggar so hairy?
Uh-huh.
Richard Wordsworth himself said the character was originally supposed to be, undoubtedly shown to be, a half-man, half-wolf. But British censors said no. They wouldn't allow rape by werewolf. Apparently, rape by strangely hairy guy was okay, but rape by werewolf was a no.
Bestiality and all that.
I guess. Good point, yeah. Now, Yvonne Romain set a new standard for Hammer cleavage. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hammer was known for cleavage from day one. He had Hazel Court and The Curse of Frankenstein. But, you know, she literally put it over the top.
Oh, Christopher.
Now, she has an interesting film history with Oliver Reed because she played his mother here. They never share any screen time. And then she's his sister in the film The Brigand of Kandahar, which I have not seen. I guess it's a swashbuckler. Mm. And she's also his love interest in Captain Clegg or the Night Creatures, which is Hammer's version of Dr. Sin, alias the Scarecrow.
Oh, okay.
That's the one with Peter Cushing, and he's like Dr. Bliss instead of Dr. Sin because they had to work out something with Disney because Disney was threatening to sue them or something while they were trying to make it, and they worked something out. Oddly enough, many of the publicity shots for this film show Oliver Reed in full wolf makeup holding Romain, which is quite impossible, of course. But let's face it, not to be mean, she was more of an attractive draw than Catherine Feller, who played Christina, who just had kind of a sweet look about her.
Yeah, I mean,
she's pretty, sweet. Yeah, but she's not, boom. I mean, you know, Yvonne Romain is like
brick.
Yeah, she's like Ingrid Pitt quality, you know? Yeah.
It's like, she's brick in the house.
Yeah, yeah, brick hammer house, yeah. You know, the more I watch this, the more when we get to it, her rape by the beggar is even more disturbing, considering it showed the two were friends, quote-unquote, while she was younger. And, you know, well, she was his friend. She smiled at him, and he just kind of winked at her creepily.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of nasty. Of course, rape's never not nasty, but it's even nastier since he knew her as a little girl. So, here's a question also Andrew brought up. Did the servant girl, who, like we said, has no name, kill the beggar/prisoner? Or did he just die from too much exhaustion?
Yeah.
You know, I tend to think she killed him because she gets up, looks over, and he's dead.
Yeah.
Now, you don't really see any marks on him, but I tend to think she killed him after he raped her, and then she passed out. Because she takes no time to contemplate killing the Marquis. She just walks in and just stabs him repeatedly.
Well, and I mean, she's smart about it that, you know, she's got it behind her back. She doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
She goes in there with the intention of killing him.
Oh, yeah. It's premeditated, which, you know, who can blame her?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that the voiceover by Alfredo changed the original intention of the scenes when it came to how long the girl was in the woods? Because it showed her run into the woods, you know, the same woods that Hammer's always...
Oh, yeah.
I think it's like, what's the name of it? Black Park or something. It's right next to Bray Studios. And, you know, same place where Ingrid Pitt stalked the doctor in Vampire Lovers. And, you know, she shows her run away into the woods, and she, like, slumps against a tree log and just sits there. And then the next scene, you hear Alfredo said, the girl stayed in the woods for several months. Lived in the woods for several months. And then he comes up on her, and she's face down in the river.
Well, I've got a theory about that.
Okay.
I think that probably when she realized she was pregnant, she tried to commit suicide.
Mm.
And that would be, you know, it might have been several months along before she realized, oh.
Yeah.
You know, she was pregnant. That's true. Because if she was raised in the castle with just her father and maybe not with other females, you know,
right,
around her, it might have taken her several months to figure out she was pregnant.
This is true. Yeah. Ooh, that made it even worse. Wow. Okay.
But that's what I took from it.
Yeah. Well, that's, I like, okay, I'll go with that.
Headcanon accepted.
Yes. Now, Clifford Evans, as Don Alfredo, gets top billing, as we said. And the following year, he would play the vampire-destroying hero, Professor Zimmer, in Hammer's Kiss of the Vampire. That's the one where he calls on black magic to send a horde of bats after the vampire cult. It was originally intended to be the ending for Brides of Dracula with Peter Cushing, you know, where Van Helsing uses the windmill and cauterizes his, you know, Van Helsing's badass movie, you know.
Yeah.
And Peter Cushing said, no, Van Helsing would never use black magic to stop a vampire.
No, no.
Which just makes me love Peter Cushing that much more. So, so they used it in that movie. And Professor Zimmer was a lot more unstable vampire hunter. He was a recluse. He was Van Helsing gone awry, you know.
Yeah.
He plays a totally different character in that than he does as Don Alfredo here. Don Alfredo's very kind and loving, and I like him in both movies. So do we think this business about being an unwanted child born on Christmas Day is a real superstition, or is it just made up? I didn't look it up.
I didn't either. I have no idea.
I probably should have, but... You know, I don't know.
It seems reasonable, though.
Yeah, I mean, it, with all the other superstitions back then, it does. It doesn't seem like it's implausible. Really, nothing was implausible when it came to superstition back then.
But here's the thing, and this, how do they know that the baby was unwanted if she can't speak?
Hmm. Good point, unless she had some kind of scars on her from, you know. Because, you know, a lot of times they can tell when somebody's been, you know.
Yeah, but that's usually within 48 hours. Mm. If they had been in the woods for several months.
Yeah. Well, we're getting into a nasty part of this movie. Let's not get that deep.
Okay, sorry.
So, as we've talked to discuss the synopsis of the movie, we know that the priest is later very knowledgeable about werewolves and possession. So, why didn't he try to do something for Leon then? I mean, he had to know of his background, and you think the sky darkening and baptismal waters boiling would have given him some kind of clue this kid was going to be bad business.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, why didn't he take him aside and say, you know, we really need to get that kid off to a monastery or something?
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, it kind of makes you wonder.
Because, I mean, I'm sorry, but kids were sent at the age of 7, usually, to start monastery.
Right. I mean, obviously he's an infant, but...
Right, but yeah. Still.
You know, of course, through all these Hammer movies, like we said, you see familiar faces. George Woodbridge plays Dominique, who is the farmer that has the dog that Pepe thinks is doing the killings. He played the inn owner in Horror of Dracula, for instance. Mm-hmm. Pepe is actually surprisingly important to the plot of this movie. The first,
you think it, his the first interaction on screen is, you know, just a throwaway.
Yeah,
you but don't, it keeps coming back. It
keeps coming back to him. I know the first time I watched this movie, which I was trying to think, when did I first watch this movie? I think I was a teenager, and it was on TBS or TNT. Used to show a lot of Hammer movies.
Oh yeah, they did.
And I watched the hell out of them, and I think that's where I first saw it. So Leon killed his own pet cat.
Yeah.
Ugh.
And he loves that. He loves his kitten, you know.
Yeah. Ugh. That's even more disturbing, and it's subtly mentioned. If you're not paying attention, you'll miss it. So I like that. Like we said, Leon hasn't had much of an appetite lately. Gee, I wonder why. Justin Walters, who plays little Leon, does bear a close resemblance to Oliver Reed. You can imagine him being Oliver Reed as a kid.
Yeah.
And for a kid actor, he does well with the material, although his lisp makes it hard to hear him say wolf.
Yeah.
He doesn't really enunciate the W very well. And he's like, I'm oof. You know, it's like, what? The first time you listen to it. But he's a little kid, so. It's not funny, but.
I don't know how this happened.
For some reason, little Leon talking about tasting the sweet blood has become a running gag around our house. It's like.
I tasted
the blood and it was warm and I liked it and I wanted some more. It was sweet and Peppa said no.
You know, just something else.
This is
I did bad, didn't I, Uncle?
Oh, no. He's like, oh my God, this kid is a freak. It never occurred to me until this viewing. But John Gabriel, who played the priest, has a bit of a Peter Cushing vibe going on about him.
Yeah,
he's got even similar features.
Uh-huh.
He's not as, you know, he doesn't have that kind of, you know, even though Peter Cushing's kind of a small guy, he's got that
commanding
man of action presence, uh-huh. Especially when he's younger, because he bursts into action, you know,
on screen.
All the times it's his own doing. He comes up with it. Well, I would run across the table, pull the drapes down, and you know. And, you know, it comes up with his own action sequences and does his own stunts and stuff. So, you know, but you know, you could see Peter Cushing kind of slipping into this role. They'd have to boost it probably a little bit and give him more to do because it's Peter Cushing. But I like the guy that plays the priest fine. And then we get Michael Ripper. That's the 1951 Down Place guys always talk about Michael Ripper. He is Hammer's most prolific actor. And he makes an appearance as the old soak who first gives Pepe the idea that he's not dealing with a normal wolf. And then, of course, later he shows up in the jail cell, unfortunately, and gets to witness Leon's transformation
there.
Yes. So we just mentioned last time that the silver bullet entered werewolf lore in House of Frankenstein. This may have been its second appearance, as the Wolfman is not dispatched that way in his next two films.
Right.
So he's not taken out by a silver bullet in House of Dracula or Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and then that's the end of him.
Right.
So there may have been other werewolf movies that used it, but I'm not aware of them at this point. This Hammer Universal release adds the wrinkle of it being made from a silver crucifix for good measure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a neat little... I mean, Ilonka makes it out of her necklace, but I don't think it was a crucifix.
A cross,
right. Yeah, it wasn't a cross or a crucifix. When Leon is trying to get out through the bars, that kid looks nuts.
I
mean, he's got, you know, his eyes are huge. He's got those big blue eyes like Oliver Reed's got anyway.
Yeah.
And he's just pulling at those bars, and his arms are as hairy as mine. And he's got those fangs. It's disturbing, really. I mean, because he's such a cute little cherubic face.
Yeah.
And he's just, you know, I mean, it's like Children of the Corn or something, you know.
The only bad thing is, you know, he's shown to be like 7 or 8 or so here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they say it's 10 years later when Oliver Reed finally does show up. And I'm sorry, but Oliver Reed looks perpetually 40.
Yeah, but he was in his early 20s.
I know, but I'm just saying, you know.
It's all that drinking.
I guess. But I mean, he does.
He looks perpetually rugged. I mean, it's just, he's got that rugged look about him. And we finally get to Oliver Reed. Oh, wait a minute, hold on. Before we get to Oliver Reed, I just want to say this, and I hate to bring this up, but I sure hope that old dog wasn't hurt in the making of this picture. When I see animals with fake blood or something on them in old movies, it makes me a little worried.
Yeah.
Because I was just reading in the Hammer book, there's a movie called The Shadow of the Cat that is about this cat that witnesses these people murder this old woman to get her fortune. And they begin to get freaked out that the cat's going to somehow implicate them in the murder. Like he's going to, you know, take people to the woman's, you know, grave out in the yard or something. I haven't seen the movie, but I was just reading about it. And they borrowed like a cat from a, like a nearby old lady or something. And he wasn't very cooperative. So they brought in some other stray black cats. Of course, it was a black cat. And they hooked up some kind of mild electrical shock to the cat to try to make it like, you know,
freak out.
And the special effect guy had it over his head to kind of basically throw it into the shot. And when they shocked him, he crapped all over his head. He diarrheaed all over his head.
Good.
I know. I was kind of like, that is just wrong. I mean, that's no movie is worth hurting a cat.
An animal. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. So, you know, it's like, I didn't like, I mean, I know it was different times and people weren't as sensitive about animals and things back then, but still, and apparently when they gave, according to that book, Marcus Ahern's book, when they gave the cat back to the old lady, it wasn't even the right cat. The original cat ran off after that, and they never found him. So the old woman got a replacement cat and probably didn't even know it. So it was bad all the way around.
Aww.
I don't think I want to see that movie now.
No. Poor kitty.
So I hope this dog wasn't hurt. That's, you know, he just, it was shown like breathing really heavy. I mean, he was still breathing, and he had blood, like fake blood on him. So I'm hoping that they just poured fake blood on him. They trained him to lay down.
Yeah.
It's just like, why in the hell didn't they, in that cat movie, get a trained cat that are trained for movies?
Okay.
It's a cat.
It's a cat.
I know, but they still have trained, I mean.
A trained cat. It's not possible. It's a cat. They do whatever the crap they want, when they want.
Well, but they are cats that are trained for movies and things, within reason. I mean, they made the freaking That Darn Cat back in the 60s at Disney.
They did what he, they filmed around that cat.
Well, I'm sure they did, but I mean, still, you know, don't.
Well, just keep going.
Electrocute a cat.
No, I agree, but let's keep going. Because, you know, just keep
so going. So, back to Oliver Reed. He shows up finally, and he had made a few uncredited but memorable appearances in Hammer films before this, including The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll and The Men of Sherwood Forest. This was his first starring role, and it put him on the map with Hammer in a very successful, if somewhat notorious, career. He's probably best known for roles in the musical version of Oliver, Tommy, the musical based on the Who opera, and the Three Musketeers films that were produced by the Salkinds and directed by Richard Lester, who, of course, worked on the Superman movies.
Right.
Reed is, maybe it's something to do with playing a werewolf, but, you know, Reed followed in Lon Chaney Jr.'s footsteps of apparently having a very bad alcohol problem and being a rowdy brawler, to the point where he even, in later movies, not in this movie, but sometime after this movie, he got in a bar fight, and you'll notice in any other movie after this one or around this time, he's got a scar that runs down from his, I think it's his left side of his lip, is all the way down to his chin, and they couldn't, that's the best they could repair it. And he thought it could ruin his career, but it honestly just made him look more rugged and crazy looking, honestly, which he played into. You know, he even predicted his own death, although probably wasn't much of a stretch to anyone who knew anything about him. He died of a heart attack in a bar in Malta after out drinking and out arm wrestling a group of sailors while filming Ridley Scott's Gladiator. And he was 61 years old, beating like young sailors at arm wrestling and drinking. And he apparently never made any, I mean, he never apologized for his ways. He was very outspoken. I like to drink. I like women. Screw it. You know, I mean, he was a carouser, man. He was just, you know, he was an old school man's man, I guess. So
That school needs it closed.
Well, it did. But despite all that, he plays a very good part in this. It doesn't take Leon and Christina long to fall in love, though, does it?
No.
But maybe Leon secretly knows he needs love, and Rico is a total ass bag. So,
oh, yeah.
You know.
It's ass hat.
Ass hat. Yeah, I said hat.
Yeah,
it's okay. I hate to say this, but Leon's date at the dance hall brothel is below Hammer's usual standards. She's not too pretty.
But she is a brothel, so, you know, she's, you know, rode hard and put up wet.
That's true. The lady of the night looks like Gillian Anderson's rough mom. She looks quite a bit like if Gillian Anderson had a hard life.
I can see that.
She's got the same eyes and the red hair and everything. Benjamin Frankel's music is very powerful. It fits in with the hammer music of James Bernard and others. But sometimes it gets a bit overpowering. Like, I don't know if you noticed, when Leon first starts feeling the moon's influence in the brothel, I mean, the music's just like, da-da! You know, I mean, it's like, okay, that's a little too much of a subtle moment for that
big crescendo.
Crescendo, yeah. But overall, it fits the dramatic nature of the movie. So with this first death we see, we're going to be teased by the werewolf design for a bit. And I think it's a good call to build suspense. But unlike other monster movies, it's not really necessary because it's a great design, so it's not going to let you down at the end.
Right.
A lot of monster movies won't show you. Then you see it, then you're like, oh. Like we brought up Silver Bullet and It, big giant spider. Yeah.
Both Stephen King.
Yeah, true. And one was a Hollywood movie. The other was TV. So, but yeah,
I didn't realize that both of them were.
Of course, he didn't make the movies, but Leon's reaction to his condition is well played by Reed. It's much like Lon Chaney. He's a bit broad, but how would you react to such news in a subtle way? You wouldn't, you know, be like, oh, I'm a werewolf. Well, how do I deal with that? Is there a support group for that? No, you'd be going, no, you know, and beating your head against the table. And actually, this isn't really funny, but the scene where Leon walks back to the vineyard, it shows Reed. It's this real, you know, lots of clanging music, and it's just like the, you know, just emphasizing the horror, the personal turmoil he's going through, realizing what he is. He's pulling at his hair. He's falling all over the place. He's, you know, falling into mounds of dirt along the roadside. And you got to just imagine that was probably just an average night for Oliver Reed walking home from the bar.
But here's the thing. Why didn't, you know, Don Alfredo go after him?
I don't know. Good point.
You know, why didn't he?
Because they needed him to have interaction with Christina. And maybe they didn't think he went back there. But he went right back where you thought he would go. He would go back, the only place he knew.
Right.
But I don't know. Christina later says Leon hurt his leg when he passed out. But it looks like he just freaked out. It looks like he's going up the stairs and just like, and just falls over. So I don't know if that was a editing thing. They didn't get the shot where he hurt his leg. It just looks like he basically, like, you know, passed out from like a panic attack or something. So why didn't the police just go ahead and run Leon in? It seemed like they had enough evidence to at least hold him the first time.
Yeah.
You know, this is kind of odd. I have to wonder, did we have an abandoned plot point left in during the discussion between Alfredo, the priest, and Leon in jail? Because Leon mentions he'll have to be burned alive, but that's totally forgotten later, and we're back to the silver bullet.
That's true.
So it's like, where did that come from and where did it go? You know, he's not a witch, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he's possessed, I guess, but they're tying in possession with werewolfism, lycanthropy, but.
Well, because, you know, he talked about bestial spirits, you know.
Yeah, so. But I mean, still. You really can't blame the mayor for not believing Alfredo and the priest, but.
You know, who you know, would?
The guy that played the mayor shows up in Taste of Blood of Dracula for Hammer later. You would think the priest in particular would fight for Christina to stay, but he doesn't put up any fight. I mean, because he knows that, you know, he needs somebody that loves him to stay with him.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, well, okay, I'm gone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. An hour and 24 minutes in, and we finally see our werewolf. But it's a great shot with him in shadow staring at the camera, and then he seems to eat it. I mean, comes right at it. I mean, it's quite the jump scare. Hammer regular Roy Ashton designed the werewolf's makeup, and it's very impressive. It gives us a more animalistic beast than either Henry Hole or Lon Chaney before.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I like it better than the Wolfman, but it's more just furious and just, I mean, I think what they did with around his brow, gave him a furrowed brow, mm-hmm. and they left enough of Oliver Reed's face unaltered because, you know, Oliver Reed can have a scary face because he's a scary guy.
Right.
So they were smart to do that. I just noticed while pulling clips from this, but we have red brown eyes for the werewolf at the beginning, green eyes when he first turns to the old soak in the cell as he's changing. He turns around when he's half transformed and his eyes are green.
My Hulk moment.
Yeah, and then Reed's natural blue eyes in full blown werewolf mode for the rest of the film. That's really strange.
Makes you wonder if he didn't have a reaction to the contacts.
In the beginning?
Yeah.
Maybe he accidentally picked up Christopher Lee's Dracula. Those are mine. Leave my contacts alone.
But I mean, I wonder if he didn't have a reaction to the contacts, and you know, they filmed, you know, because where he was crying, whether that was from irritation or from supposed to be from emotion.
That just made me think, God, good Lord, why didn't they make a Christopher Lee Dracula versus werewolf movie? I mean, with Oliver Reed. Yeah. I mean, that, can you imagine who would win in that fight? I mean, because Oliver Reed's a brawler, but freaking Christopher Lee was a freaking British intelligence officer.
Uh-huh.
And he ain't with no pansy.
No.
And he was a lot more dignified, but I kind of think Christopher Lee would know how to take him out. He might, you know, he might be able to get a few punches in, but, and as far as in the monster, they could, God, that makes me want to see that movie. Throw in, I mean, why didn't Hammer never did a monster rally?
Yeah.
They never did. I mean, can you imagine if they brought back Oliver Reed and they had Christopher Lee and then they had Peter Cushing as Baron Frankenstein? I mean, or would you have him as Van Helsing?
Hmm.
We could do both. I'm sorry, I got way off topic, but it's like, oh my God, that's awesome. Hammer wasn't big on angry mobs as Universal, but it's fitting we have one in this Universal release.
Yeah,
we got the
yeah.
torch, you know. We have Leon, the parkour werewolf.
Oh,
it's going all over the roofs and bouncing off walls and climbing, and you know, there's some YouTube videos out there probably if you want to check it out. Now that's an impressive gunshot that kills Leon, but shouldn't the blood shoot out the back of him and not the front?
Yeah. But they had the blood packet
in the front. Yeah. And the editing where Leon rise and falls could be a bit tighter. It hesitates just a second too long, I think. It could have just been cut just a little bit tighter. But we're used to real quick cuts nowadays in movies, so that might be part of it. Unlike Larry Talbot, Leon doesn't revert back to human form after death, which makes it all the sadder. His family is left to bury him in beast form.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, oh, they don't even get him back. You know, it's like, they got to bury that, you know. And
honestly, he's not going to be able to be on consecrated ground or anything like
right.
that.
Right, yeah. They'll probably have to burn him, you know, honestly. So, man, we're getting really dark with this.
We are.
This is one of my favorite Hammer films. Like I said, I think I saw it on TBS or TNT. According to the Hammer story, I saw one thing where it said the film did pretty well, but I saw another where it said the double feature, I can't remember the other movie it was paired with, didn't do what they wanted it to do. So I guess it was kind of a mediocre release, right. Which is probably why, you know, Hammer never revisited the werewolf concept, either as a sequel or with a new take. But that's just a shame because, you know, Hammer made a ton of Dracula and Frankenstein sequels. They made 4 Mummies movies and, you know, they made the Karnstein trilogy, and so it's just a shame. You know, maybe Hammer just figured it wasn't worth it because, like we said, the British censors shredded the film, making so many cuts, I doubt the film made any sense. According to the book I just read, America's cuts were far less intrusive.
Is there a director's cut out there somewhere?
The cut that's out now restored everything I think they have.
Oh, okay.
As far as I know. It's the cut that's on the DVD. We've got this one in that 8 movie Hammer set that we also had. Did we do another movie from that set? I can't remember. I don't think we did. I don't think we ever did another one from that set. But it's got Brides of Dracula. It's got the Hammer Phantom of the Opera. And it's got a few of the... It's got the Evil of Frankenstein. And it's got a few of the suspense mini Hitchcock thrillers. So, now some people think that Hammer did make a sequel, but that film is a Tyburn production called The Legend of the Werewolf, made in the early 70s. I recently watched this movie, and I can see why folks think that it's related to Hammer, because the werewolf design is very similar to the Leon design. It stars Peter Cushing, he's not the werewolf, but he's a morgue doctor, is directed by Hammer regular Freddie Francis, and it has music by James Bernard. So it's a very Hammer-like production.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Amicus and Tyburn and Tygon were all using the Hammer players as well in England at that time. The one weird thing about this, since Universal owned the rights to the film, and they still do, they worked Leon into some of their monster craze merchandising of the 60s. Infamously, in Milton Bradley's Monster Old Maid game, Leon is called the Wolfman, a picture of him, while Larry Talbot is called the Werewolf. So they switched them.
Yeah.
Oddest of all, Henry Hull's Werewolf of London is identified as Teenage Werewolf, which Universal didn't even own. That's the Michael Landon movie.
Right, right.
which is not has never been released on DVD. The guy that owns it's holding out. It's like, what are you holding out for, dude? Do you think it's going to be worth more money when everybody who ever remembered it's dead? I mean, you know. I remember, I've never seen the movie. I've seen they did that Highway to Heaven episode.
Yeah.
There was a Halloween one where
basically put the makeup back.
Yeah, Victor French was watching the movie on TV, and he had a dream that Michael Landon's, what was his name, his character, the angel guy, I can't think of his name.
Oh,
but
I don't know.
That he kept coming in at him as a werewolf,
mm-hmm.
and he was back in the similar makeup. It was cool. I thought it was awesome. And my mom's like, I saw that movie. My mom went and saw all those crazy old horror movies back then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she saw the big ant movie, you know, I mean, all sorts of stuff. So, even stranger, elements of Leon crept into classic Wolfman merchandise. The Mark's Wolfman figure, they made they're about 4 inches tall, army man type immobile figures that I have a few of them, including the Wolfman. He sports the ripped, flouncy shirt and cummerbund of Leon, and the Soaky figure, which was, of course, a Palmolive.
Oh, yeah.
Bubble bath figure. He has the little ears up top like Leon does, because Leon's got like the pointed ears up top, whereas the Wolfman's just got regular human ears.
Yeah.
He's actually got both, which is weird. It's got two sets of ears.
Huh.
So
better to hear you with, my dear.
I think there's a couple of other pieces of merchandise, like I think a wallet or something that shows the Wolfman with Leon's ears. And he's got the cummerbund and the black pants and the flouncy shirt on, so... It's really strange how that happened, but so that's the Curse of the Werewolf. I recommend it. I just think it's a shame that Hammer didn't do a sequel, or you know, I mean, obviously Larry Talbot died in a similar fashion and came back, so Leon could have, and as many times as Dracula came back, you know, I mean, we could have brought him back. So what did you think?
It's one of those. I mean, it's a horror classic for me.
Yeah.
So.
It's just the fairy tale nature of it. It's like a doomed fairy tale, you know. It's almost a Shakespearean in a Romeo and Juliet kind of way, star-crossed lovers, you know. Even more so than like some of the Wolfman movies. So we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll jump into a comic that has a werewolf.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalog and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
We're back, and we're going to jump into the dusty long boxes in the House of Frankenstein. Dare to go into the crypt and grab a comic real quick.
We pulled them from the attic.
It's in the crypt, man, not the attic. It's got to be in the crypt.
You store your comics where you want, and I'll store my comics where I want.
Okay, apparently the Marvels are in the attic, and the DCs are in the crypt. How's that?
Okay.
Okay.
So yours are moldy and mine are dusty.
Yours got all warped from the heat and stuff up there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to look at Spectacular Spider-Man number 152, dated July 1989, on sale March 28th, 1989, according to Mike's Amazing World. Again, no Halloween. The cover by Sal Buscema shows a battered and bloody Spider-Man leaning up against the crumbling foundation of a brick wall, protecting the prone and exhausted body of an equally battered J. Jonah Jameson. The reason for the dilemma? A pair of werewolves stalking them and drawing near as a full moon shines behind them. The cover blurb reads, "The Lobo Brothers attack, and the nightmare begins." A Wolf's Tale was written by Gary Conway. He did the script. Sal Buscema, the art. Rick Parker, letters. Bob Sharon, color. Jim Salakrup, editor. Tom DeFalco, editor-in-chief.
Our story begins much like the cover, with a tattered J. Jonah Jameson leaning on Spider-Man as they flee from the rampaging werewolves across a demolition site. Spidey pleads with his greatest annoyance to keep running, but Jonah is exhausted. He can't go on. Spidey gently lays Jameson down, and despite how he has treated him over the years, turns to defend his employer from their bestial foes. But it does little good. As one of the werewolves savagely lashes out at the web-slinger, the other attacks Jameson and bites down with a sickening crunch. Spider-Man witnesses this grisly murder seconds before the other werewolf slashes his throat with his inhuman claws.
One werewolf asks the other, "Your first kill, how did it taste?" The other answers, "Hot, sweet." The experienced werewolf reverts to the form of a man named Eduardo Lobo, while the other changes into the female form of Jameson's secretary and Peter Parker's friend, Gloria Grant. The two naked lycanthropes embrace, Gloria's lover calling her a child of the wolves, a daughter of the moon. Gloria transforms again as he tells her that now she has tasted blood, nothing will tear them apart.
Your Latin accent, oh my.
I didn't do
the hot and bothered.
We didn't talk about how the fact that in the Hammer movie everybody's got a British accent and nobody really tries to do a Spanish accent.
No.
Yeah, they rarely do, but that's okay.
Gloria wakes up. It was only a nightmare, or was it? The answer lies at the foot of her bed. There sits Eduardo, her boyfriend, the werewolf. She thinks back to the night before, how she came home and gave Eduardo the file he wanted from Jameson's Daily Bugle. The file on Wilson Fisk, a.k.a. the Kingpin. Eduardo told her he no longer needed her and revealed his horrifying secret. He changed in front of her and then Gloria passed out. So now she sits, the beast that was the man she loved, staring at her.
Outside the apartment, Gloria's friend and co-worker, reporter Joey Mercado, watches. She's been following Gloria, concerned about her falling in with a known gangster like Lobo. She spies Spider-Man swinging across the New York skyline. Spidey is on his way to a warehouse where the Lobo's mob is receiving an illegal weapon shipment. He received the tip from the Arranger, the Kingpin's right-hand man, who asked for Spider-Man's help in stopping the Lobo brothers from starting a gang war with Fisk.
After setting up his automatic camera, Spidey interrupts the sale, making quick work of the thugs. But not even his Spidey sense expected a werewolf attack. The furry beast leaps at our hero, whose reflexes overcompensate, sending him through the warehouse wall and into the harbor below. When he makes his way back to the surface, he finds that the warehouse is empty of werewolves, guns, and goons. Later, as Peter Parker, he finds Jameson isn't interested in his photos, although, as his friends Flash Thompson and Harry Osborn point out, he is interested in connecting Spidey to the recent mob violence.
We cut to an unrelated subplot involving Peter's friend and Daily Bugle editor Joe Robertson in prison, where he's serving time for not coming forward against the mobster known as Tombstone. Tombstone is trying to make life hard on Robbie in the joint. Let's get back to the werewolf, shall we?
The following night, Spidey pays a visit to the Arranger, confirming the Lobos are readying for all-out war. The Arranger is hopeful his machinations will eliminate the competition and Spider-Man.
Back at her apartment, Gloria watches the now-human Eduardo Lobo pace her bedroom floor. She asks why he didn't kill her last night, but Eduardo doesn't answer her directly. Instead, he tells her a story. A story of how he and his brother Carlos grew up as homeless thieves in the Latin American town of Puebla de Zaragoza. As they grew, the boys noticed they could hunt best at night, their eyesight greater than others. Carlo was more violent than his brother Eduardo, who was smitten with the lovely Esmelda Valdez, daughter of a rich local rancher. One day, while watching Esmelda, he spooked her horse and saved her from her fall. From then on, the two were inseparable. That is, until Esmelda's brother Ramon caught them. He did not approve of his sister cavorting with a mere street urchin. He whipped Eduardo and sent him running away. Enraged, Eduardo's mind filled with thoughts of murder, and the full moon transformed his body to accommodate his bloodlust. He became a werewolf and returned to attack Ramon and his men.
The next morning, a human Eduardo awoke amongst the bloody and lifeless bodies of the men he hated and the woman he loved, slain by his own clawed hands. Eduardo later realized that he and his brother were mutants, something his brother Carlos enjoyed. He used his power to take over the South Texas mob with Eduardo by his side. Recently, the Kingpin had sent the Punisher to slay them, and such an action could not be ignored. So the brothers came to New York to settle the score.
Eduardo admits he used Gloria to get Jameson's info on the Kingpin, but she became more than a pawn. The two kiss as Joy photographs them from across the street. She wants to help her friend, but questions if she's crossing a moral line in trying to do so. Meanwhile, Spider-Man contemplates the same problem, having thrown in with one of his greatest enemies to defeat two new ones.
He returns home to his Aunt May's boarding house and his new wife, Mary Jane. He unloads his moral quandary onto his wife, worrying that his allegiance with the Arranger may result in even more deaths than it prevents. Eavesdropping on the two is Mary Jane's visiting 16-year-old cousin, Christy, who is horrified to hear that Peter may be in danger, as she's in love with him. She also harbors another secret, but this comic won't tell us what it is. For that, you'll have to dive back into some more back issue bins.
Yes. Don't come into the house of Frankenstein, though. I can't assure your safety. In the attic or the crypt.
Yeah. My comics are in the crypt.
Yeah. The cover...
I mean, my comics are in the attic.
Yeah, your comics are in the attic. The cover on this one is pretty sweet. It's 2 seconds from some serious werewolf smackdown. The werewolves are of the very lupine variety, very, you know, American Werewolf in London. Wolves walking on two legs, really. It's got nice, moody colors, too. If you notice, Spidey has a limited number of webs on his costume on the cover, but inside he has twice that amount, at least, even though they were drawn by the same artist. More than likely, Buscema drew the cover first before the Marvel edict for all artists to copy the eyes and webbings of then-hot Amazing Spider-Man artist Todd McFarlane came down.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody said, copy Todd McFarlane, that stuff's selling like crazy. The creative team, Jerry Conway and Sal Buscema, were the original writer-artist combo when the title launched in the late 70s. Conway had recently left DC and was writing both this book and Web of Spider-Man. So there's a lot of crossover between those two books. The opening sequence is a nice bait and switch. Since we saw it on the cover, we assume this scene is actually taking place until, of course, Jameson and Spidey are killed, which
right.
That's not going to happen. But no. It's still pretty shocking, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the amount of blood in a code-approved comic in 1989. I mean, it's not gory. I mean, it's not overly, but there's a lot of inky blood with a couple red spots in it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's actually kind of ugh. Buscema was a master at drawing bombastic action, and that translates into some truly ferocious werewolves. I think it looks really sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Gloria Grant first appeared in Amazing Spider-Man number 140 in 1975, also written by Jerry Conway. She was a supporting character in the books from then onward, but as far as I know, this is her first major storyline.
Okay.
Joy Mercado was an occasional supporting character in the Spider-Man books, although she debuted in Moon Knight of all places.
Hmm.
So, that's kind of interesting. Spidey never seems to be put out by seeing an actual werewolf, but he shouldn't because he's fought Man-Wolf many times, and he also encountered Werewolf by Night a couple times, which we covered a couple years ago, which I know you just loved that story.
Mm-hmm.
The Spidey books, much like the Superman books at the time, were really good at juggling a large supporting cast. It was always a hallmark of the Spidey titles, but this period in particular had many subplots floating in and out of the spotlight, such as the brief segments with Flash and Harry, and, of course, the Robbie Tombstone thread,
mm-hmm.
which was quite shocking for the time. I remember, like, they actually sent Robbie to jail. I mean, wow, you know. And it was, like, you know, one of the first times I ever saw a comic book, like, tackle life in prison, you know.
Right,
with
right.
With the you know, being in the system and trying to protect yourself and making allegiances with people against others and everything. You think after so many years on the job, Spidey would be smart enough to not get mixed up with the Kingpin in any way, but then you'd have no story. So.
Yeah, it was in the script.
Yeah, right. And then we get the Lobo Brothers origin. And it's really only a 4-page sequence, but Conway and Buscema paint a pretty full picture of these characters. Yeah, there are some cliches here, but they work. It has a Southwestern fairy tale horror story vibe to it.
Right.
It almost feels like something from a werewolf spinoff of From Dusk Till Dawn or something.
Yeah.
You know, I could see that working in there. I haven't watched the TV series, but which apparently has Wilmer Valderrama from That 70s Show in it. He's in the TV
series. Really?
Yes, Fez, yes.
No.
It's on Netflix. We should watch it sometime.
Huh.
Yeah. And of course, the Hispanic werewolf with romance thrown in was just too much of a coincidence not to pair with Curse of the Werewolf.
Oh, yeah.
So when I thought of this one, I'm like, ding! You know. It's pretty shocking that Eduardo killed Esmelda, and it shows her with a bloody throat even.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, wow. You know, you would think, I was expecting, I mean, I read this one years ago, but I'd kind of forgotten the particulars.
I mean, I was expecting that she was going to say, oh, I can't believe you did this, or,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, killed my brother, I hate you, you know, and. And
or she was going to get caught in the crossfire, or, you know,
right.
Something. But this was by his own hand.
Yeah, he killed her. I mean, just straight up. You know, and of course, it comes as no surprise that this was Marvel in the 80s, and we get a one-panel cameo by the Punisher. Because, you know, it's the Punisher. Which Conway also co-created. Conway does a good job of tying in all the moral compromises the cast is making, because obviously Gloria's making one because she's in love with this guy.
Right.
Joy's making one because, you know, she's trying to help her friend, and Spider-Man's making one because he's trying to prevent a greater evil. So there's a lot of moral conflict amongst the heroic characters in this one, which I think is really, really nice. Now, we won't leave you hanging. If you want to know Christie's secret, and if you don't, just skip ahead a few minutes, but she has bulimia. And it was actually handled pretty well, as I recall, across the Spider-Man books. There's one point where she passes out in Aunt May's bathroom, and they can't get in. She's got the door locked, and they have to break the door down. And it was handled. It wasn't. There was no superheroic element. She didn't, you know, it wasn't some, you know, some food thing by the Kingpin, or, you know, it was straight up just real life bulimia,
yeah.
Which I thought was handled really well. The Lobo Brothers story continued to weave in and out of both Spectacular and Web of Spider-Man, like I said. And if you want to know how that ends, and in case you don't, like I said, forward ahead a little bit. How does the Lobo Brothers Gloria thing wrap up? I don't have these books, but thanks to the Marvel Wiki, I looked it up. In a final blowout between the Lobos, the Kingpin's mob, and Spidey, Gloria tries to shoot at Spidey, but kills Eduardo instead. Now, was it a silver bullet? I don't know, because he's a mutant, not a... It's like, yeah, you know, does he have to be a mutant? Because we already got regular werewolves, you know?
So then, does Gloria go to jail? Does... You know, what happens with Carlos? Because, you know, did he survive? And, you know.
I don't know. I didn't look that part up.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Somebody can write in and tell us, or I can go look it up afterwards. But you can write in and tell us anyway. Despite this comic being in the middle of several storylines, the creative team manages to get the reader up to speed enough to know what's going on and enjoy the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that is no small feat, and one that isn't pulled off very often, especially nowadays.
Right.
Because
right.
You pick up a comic in the middle of a story and you're like, what the hell is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, it's done really well. It's not beating you over the head. Previously in Spider-Man, you know, or, you know, it's like, you know, not the characters saying, I've been following Gloria for weeks now. I tracked her from the Daily Bugle to here, her boyfriend's apartment, or, you know, her apartment
right.
Where she's with her boyfriend, who I think is a mobster. You know, I mean, it's nothing. It's handled really well.
Mm-hmm.
But Jerry Conway's just a good writer. So what'd you think of this?
I liked it. I mean, I wanted, like I said, I wanted to find out what, that right. Was the first thing I said, what happens? You handed me this comic, and I'm like.
Yeah, well, I mean, it spread out too much to, you know.
Oh, I know.
And I don't think I have the I think it was in Web of Spider-Man. I think Web of Spider-Man was, I eventually dropped it, because it was kind of a little bit, it became kind of the weaker of the three titles. So eventually I dropped it. And so I think that's it wrapped up there, and I just didn't keep track of what happened to him. But yeah, you know, Marvel's Spider-Man's had plenty of run-ins with werewolves, and this is another one, gangster werewolves. You know, like I said, it was kind of ahead of its time with because you know later on we'd get mafioso type vampires and
mm-hmm.
things like Vampire the Masquerade and
right.
and even Underworld has overtones of that
mm-hmm.
and things so. You know, I think this was kind of a going in a direction that that Hollywood ended up going in with a lot of horror movies. So I think it's pretty cool. Well, I think that about does it for part 2 of The House of Frankenstein. Next time we're going to go a little off track It's still a Universal movie, so that is technically three Universal movies. This is a Universal movie. It's produced by Universal, released by Universal. It is an adaptation of a play that was also adapted into a more famous Universal monster movie. We're talking about the 1979 version of Dracula, mm-hmm. starring Frank Langella and Sir Laurence Olivier. And, you know, I know a lot of people are like, oh, you know, I don't like that one. It's too mushy or something. But I will tell you this. I hadn't seen that one for years, and we got it a few years back cheap on DVD. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised how much I liked it. So we're going to talk about it and mix things up a little bit. So come back, and we'll have, of course, a comic with a vampire in it. I'm not going to tell you what, but I think it'll be pretty cool. So we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. It is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright by respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders, and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Get away!
Leon!
Get away!
Leon, look!
No! Get away!